All right, here we go. You're listening to the Useful Science Podcast. This is episode 17, recorded on September 10th, 2017. This week, we're going to learn about sleep habits, Fitbit lawsuits, and bad science reporting. Useful Science is a website where we post one-sentence summaries of scientific research relevant to your everyday life. On this podcast, we bring on a rotating panel of scientists and enthusiasts to discuss a few of our favorite articles. We go past the headlines and dig deep into the actual research to figure out how it can benefit you in your everyday life. Let's meet our hosts for this week.
Hi, my name is Ian Mahar. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Boston University, and I did my PhD at McGill University in Montreal.
Hi, I'm Jamie K. Devine. I'm a neuroscience researcher. I predominantly do sleep and sleep behavior. I got my PhD in neuroscience at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Oxton. I'm a biologist from Vancouver, Canada. My background's in ecology and evolution, but I work now in conservation and habitat restoration.
And I'm Cameron Spencer. I'm not a scientist. I'm a web developer and web designer, and I work on the Useful Science website. So, Ian, what are we talking about today?
So I wanted to take a slightly different tack and get into the issue of science reporting in mass media because it's been on my mind lately. And here's the sort of reason that brought it all together. About a month ago, a girl I know messaged me and asked, hey, is it true that women need more sleep than men and that the reason is that their brains work harder? Now, this sounded kind of suspicious to me at face value because as a neuroscientist, I hadn't heard anything really related to that previously. So at first, I started looking into it to find out which media articles had led this person to that conclusion to try to trace that back to the science that was done and see if the claims were justified. And I was really surprised to see a long series of seemingly reputable media outlets reporting this exact finding without any criticism or refutation. Here are some of the examples discussing it from the media. And most of these were referring to a, quote, new study out of the UK, NBC News saying that women need more sleep because their brains are more complex and work harder. A National Sleep Foundation, according to Britain's leading sleep expert, women need more sleep because they use more of their actual brain. I don't know what actual brain means there, but ABC, New York Post, The Sun, AOL, Medical Daily. I mean, I looked all over the place and I actually started to get suspicious as to whether this claim really was false until I found one article that led me to what seemed to be the truth. And the interesting thing is that it was on a website called Van Winkle's. The author is Teresa Fisher, who is a writer and editor for Van Winkle's, which is a website published by Casper, the mattress company. So what really makes this story start to take a weird turn is realizing that a mattress company's sleep blog outperformed world-leading media outlets in vetting science before reporting it. And that's just the start of the weirdness of the story. Not only that, but there actually is some really solid journalism here by Teresa.
This episode brought to you by our sponsor, Casper.
Exactly, yeah. So
that's not true. We have no sponsorships.
Except maybe Fitbit. We do have a bit of a connection with them. I know that might get weird.
I think we might lose them.
But we're presenting all the science here.
Both sides. Yeah.
Yes.
So out of the mess of all the clickbaiting media articles out there, the article written by Teresa actually managed to track the initial outbreak of bad science to a UK site called Metro, which was really heavily shared, and that quoted a professor, Jim Horn, who is a real person. And the quote said, women's brains are wired differently from men's, and they're more complex, so their sleep need will be slightly greater. They also use more of their brain than men. And a man who has a complex job that involves a lot of decision-making and lateral thinking may also need more sleep than average, though still not as much as a woman. So we can kind of see why this info proliferated. It's great clickbait, and that a lot of people would be interested in it. A lot of people would probably accept it at face value, and they'd probably discuss it if they disagreed. But the really sketchy part is that there's no science article mentioned or linked in the Metro article. So there's no study that actually was coming out of the UK. And the quotes that were offered in the initial article that were spread through all the subsequent articles are from a different scientist that's not in the UK saying something else. And in fact, the guy that was quoted, Dr. Horn, says, I never said that women actually need more sleep. They just take more sleep. There's a tendency. We have not undertaken a new study. So the exact opposite of what all these huge media outlets are reporting. There isn't unequivocal evidence that women need more sleep than men. And the closest study from the guy that was quoted as Jim Horn, even though he wasn't, found that in the context of sleep deprivation, the consequences of sleep deprivation might have been worse for women, but that's totally different than the claims here. And Horn, the closest thing that Horn's ever said is he wrote a book saying that women seem to multitask more than men, which might potentially increase need for sleep recovery. But that's not a scientific finding. It's an opinion that didn't come from an article and certainly didn't come from a new peer-reviewed article. And the literature is kind of equivocal on this. Especially for the complex and more used ideas about the brain. So the media articles are a really complicated jumble of misquotes or exaggerations or flat-out inaccuracies, which is really disconcerting given how many people are reading the or listening to these sources. So the reason I wanted to talk about it here and get everyone's input is that, firstly, all this is just primarily related to the overall mission of Useful Science, which is trying to ensure the audience is getting accurate information in contrast with what they might otherwise read in media articles. That's why we give primary sources in addition to our own summaries and the media articles. Also, we've talked in the past on the podcast and in the article we wrote for The Conversation last year. We talked about media articles representing scientific articles inaccurately, but this is an entirely new level because here there's no peer-reviewed study that's actually behind the stories. But the quotes that they use seem ostensibly made up since Professor Horn totally denied saying them. So there's no critical thinking here. I was actually shocked at how easy it was to manipulate the media by just taking the name of an academic figure and just making up quotes that are likely to propagate, which shouldn't really surprise us. I mean, that's actually verbatim what Isaac Newton said when he was saying that BuzzFeed is an unreliable news source. But in addition, I think there's a bigger issue here. I think I'm skeptical about whether this is a new issue or if this is a worsening problem. I think this is a really egregious case, but is it a freak outlier or is this a vanguard of a new low in science reporting? So traditional media is in serious financial trouble. Everyone's getting their news online from less reputable experienced sources, maybe people that aren't even journalists. The news cycle is quicker and everyone's fighting desperately for every click and eyeball. So the titles are as clickbaiting as possible and the content doesn't have nuance. And less time and priority is given to actually verifying anything. So the question that I had is, are we screwed? I mean, are things going to get worse and that there's more inaccuracy and less actual correlation to the original findings and more sort of sensationalist stuff that's just meant to rile the listeners up?
All right. Well, first, I want to talk about this from my personal experience as a sleep researcher looking at gender differences with regards to sleep deprivation. So my tilt is understanding inflammation and how lack of sleep affects your ability to respond to infection and low-grade chronic inflammation. So women respond to sleep disruption or restriction or loss of sleep more than men do. So men seem more resilient to an immunological response to sleep loss than women.
And that was shown in a Duke study, a study out of Duke University in the last 10 years, right?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you can say one study that says that, or you can say all of the studies, because it's a pretty well-known finding, is that in terms of your certain aspects of sleep deprivation, women respond worse than men. So the effects of sleep deprivation are more in women than they are in men. Now,
and Jamie, when you say immunological response, you're talking about inflammation?
Yes. So in my research, why someone might be interested in this is because this chronic low-grade inflammation. So if you're constantly not getting enough sleep, then your body is acting like it is constantly under attack from an outside infection. So this is related to more weight or sickness behavior. So what people don't know is certain cytokines, which is something that your body releases as part of the immune system inflammation response, make you feel sleepy. So when you don't get enough sleep, your body's saying, hey, things aren't right. I'm going to send out my little troops. They're going to, you know, fix stuff, whatever. And one of the side effects of cytokines is that you feel more sleepy. So that's the research that I have done. However, what is important to know about sleep and sex and gender identity is that those are all very broad terms. So how sleep is good for you, how sleep is bad for you, we can spend all day. And we can spend all our, we can spend our entire careers discussing how's that, how is sleep good for you and for what aspect. We can also discuss what is sex, what is gender, because they're not the same thing. People think, you know, male, female, that's it. Well, what your genitals say you are versus what your brain and your culture says you are versus, you know, how you identify within society. These are different aspects of research. So saying like women need sleep more, men need sleep more, whatever, really boils down, and it really is a fantastic place to poorly report findings, because all of these things are such broad topics that what's good for the goose might not be good for the gander.
Right. I think this area of research is something that is so nuanced that it's easy for someone to misstep. I think that's a really important point to make. I think there are points that have been supported by research that authors could make, authors of media articles that I don't think we would have much, we wouldn't take as much issue with. For example, there has been a lot more support for, as you said, the issue of what are the consequences of sleep deprivation in terms of peripheral biomarkers and psychological distress. And what seems to be a pretty firm finding is that women are more likely to suffer from insomnia. But even reporting those would be tricky and require a lot of tact and nuance because, as you said, there's issues of how do you define sex versus gender, how were these studies done, and how much can we generalize. For example, some of those findings are only have only been found within particular age groups. So generalizing even within a sex or gender to different age groups would be problematic.
Well, and we're even one thing that's might not be known is that within insomnia, there are people who complain of problems with sleep, but when you actually measure their sleep physically, they don't look much different than a healthy control.
Right.
So the difference is between someone who's got insomnia in so much as they are concerned about their sleep, they are not happy with their sleep, versus someone whose sleep as measured by polysomnography, EEG, your smartphone app or whatever, if that is saying that it's different versus you saying, well, I'm not happy with it, those are two different problems, and those two different problems are related to different outcomes.
Right, and the studies are measuring often three different things. They're looking at subjective sleep quality, as you said, but also some people are relying on duration of overall sleep. But that's difficult too because we also know that men and women differ in how long they spend in individual stages of sleep. So sleep quality is also an additional variable that a lot of people don't look at. So the takeaway from all this discussion is to say it's tricky to talk about these things accurately or as accurately as possible, even if you really care about the truth. But it's an entirely new level when you say things that are just completely antithetical to what the research is saying, or basically based on quotes that you either misattributed or made up, seemingly.
Absolutely.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of layers of complexity in terms of the different variables and ways to look at this that for someone who isn't a PhD in the subject would be difficult to parse through. And if you are a journalist on tight deadlines and tight budgets, I can see how it would be difficult to accurately report on this. Especially, from what I've seen, there seems to be a great need and want with these articles for certainty, and this means this, rather than, there's evidence for this hypothesis. Maybe in the future we'll figure this out more solidly, but it's a kind of a gray area right now, whereas those clickbait headlines, they seem to always be very certain. Women need more sleep. End of sentence.
Right. Absolutely. I think Ian and I both have quite the advantage because one of the locations that's very good at doing gender research in terms of sleep and inflammation and all of this health is McGill. And we are both friends with Robert Paul Juster, who is a fantastic source in terms of understanding how sex, gender, and health interreact.
Yeah, Rob's a great guy. We've actually worked together on stuff in the past. Yeah, and I think he's no longer at McGill. He's doing a postdoc elsewhere. But yeah, he did some really great work up there on stress and these other variables that can sort of intervene to dictate how something as broad as stress and potentially biological correlates like inflammation might differ depending on someone's demographics.
Now, if we want to switch topics a little bit, so something that isn't difficult to understand. I don't know if you guys have had your friends send you this video, but like everybody I know has sent me this video about the unexpected health benefits of tequila or why tequila is good for you or whatever. And it's like,
I haven't seen that. No,
it is infuriating. So the video, which has no links to any research, says, science says that tequila helps lower your blood sugar and blah, blah, blah. And it just lists off a whole bunch of ridiculous stuff. And if you mine where this information came from, it's a study where they looked at the tequila plant and they looked at the sugars produced by the tequila plant, which are not in a shot of tequila, and saying that these fructans were helpful for, you know, they were like a better sugar source than something like glucose or another sugar source. So someone saw an article saying like, hey, sugar from a tequila plant must mean that a shot of tequila is good for you. And I have had friends from every source. My mother sent me this video. And it's like, no, this tequila is not upheld. Like, drink.
If you go chew on an agave leaf, yeah, that's different.
Yeah. You know, if you want to take a shot of tequila, I am with you. I will go with you and I will take that shot of tequila. But let's not pretend that this is good for your blood sugar or anything else, except for the fact that you want to forget what happened today.
And it's if you tell people what they want to hear, I mean, people are for that. Like, people are going to have tequila whether the study says it's good for you or not. But to take that shot of tequila with like the comfort of, hey, maybe this is good for me, I don't have to feel too bad about this. I mean, I can see why it's popular. It's not accurate reporting, but I can see why it got all the clicks it did.
I mean, it goes back to what Lindsay was saying earlier about all these people. Obviously, the onus is on the person writing the media article to confirm them, but they're under deadlines, or maybe they find the scientists to be inaccessible. But I want to point out that for the Teresa Fisher article, she works for a sleep mattress blog, and she was able to get several paragraphs worth of quotes directly from the scientific author. So I don't think it's difficult for them to do it. It seems like they just generally don't care as long as they're getting clicks. And the thing is, I can understand why, even though I think it's really unethical and I think basically malicious based on the fact that there could be consequences. But there's no consequences for them. There's no consequences for someone that works at BuzzFeed to say anything, because they're not really journalists. They're someone that's hired to get 47,000 eyeballs per week or whatever to their article. So, I mean, we can complain all we want about it, but I don't know if we can't get the people that write the articles to care, and no one that's reading it is going to vet the articles, I'm concerned about exactly where this takes us.
Mm. Well, I don't think, yeah, I don't think there's much you can do in terms of kind of, I don't know what the words were, but predatory journalism, where you're kind of falsifying facts just to get clicks. I think that's going to probably be there whether one likes it or not. But to have a better almost literacy for folks that, to be able to read between the lines, to be able to access the original source, and be like, oh, actually, you know what? This doesn't line up. I don't think this is actually all the facts. And it's hard. Everyone has lives to live and are busy and don't necessarily have time to do the work of a journalist to get to the bottom of a news story. So I'm hopeful in that I see that more people are interested in science and are trying to learn more about it through like popular science articles, but it is frustrating to see that those people are often being misled by fake news, basically.
If it doesn't have a link or a mention of a specific science peer-reviewed article, I don't trust it.
Yeah. It's a good rule of thumb.
Right, but you're a scientist. Your level of scientific literacy is about as high as it can get. And so I trust that you would interpret a study correctly or an article about a study correctly. But I worry about the number of people that vastly outnumbers us or even our listeners that just sort of take it tacitly without questioning it. I think that Lindsay's right that we can't really do anything to force the people that write bad science articles to change. And it's not something that we could legislate against, but I agree with her that the issue is educating the public, but I don't know exactly how to properly campaign towards getting your average member of the public to not trust a news story unless it has a primary link.
Well, speaking of primary links and legislation, let me talk to you about the Fitbit article that I want to bring up. So, I can sum up the article very quickly. So there was a independent researcher who was paid in one study by Fitbit and in another by the people suing Fitbit to test how accurate the Fitbit Charge HR, so a Fitbit that measures your heart rate, how accurate it is. So this was Edward Joe et al., and the article is called Validation of Biofeedback Wearables for... All right, nobody sneeze. Everybody make sure we've got this clear, no feedback. I am saying this word once, and then I'm using the acronym for it for the rest. Photoplethysmographic heart rate tracking. So PPG, photoplethysmography. This is a technology which measures how much light is reflected back from your skin based on the volume of blood in the tissue. This is something that's in the Fitbit Charge HR. They call it Pulse Plus technology. It's also in other light trackers like the Basic Peak, which they also tested in this study. So they had 24 individuals in this study where one heart rate monitor slash Fitbit, you know, like activity monitor on one arm, the other on the other. So they had a basic peak on one hand, a Fitbit Charge HR on the other hand, randomized. And they also had EEGs on their chest to measure their actual heart rate. And then they did a number of like aerobic activities. So biking, jogging, lunges, arm raises. And what they found was that the Fitbit Charge HR was accurate for low grade movement and resting heart rate, but it wasn't good for something like cycling, which doesn't use a lot of arm movement, or for lunges, or generally for high aerobic activity. Why this is important is Fitbit's being sued by a class action lawsuit because this is a feature of a Fitbit that you're paying extra for. So no one's arguing that a Fitbit is a medical device. And actually, they're very clear in the way they phrase, you know, this is heart rate tracking. It's not heart rate measurement. So they're very clear that this is not an absolute measure of your heart rate. But people are saying, you know, I paid extra for this and it's not accurate at measuring my heart rate when I'm doing very intense aerobic activities. So what am I paying for?
I have a question just in terms of clarification. My background's not in human anatomy. The Fitbit, the acronym that you used, can I have like the Coles Note version of how that works?
So the photoplethysmography, which I said I wasn't going to say it again. But, you know,
three times now, Jamie.
But now I'm proud because each time I've said it correctly. Go, Jamie. So PPG. All right. So look at your wrist. It's got blood running through it. If you were working out harder, more blood would be running through your wrist. So the watch, and they have explicit instructions on where to put the watch and how to wear the watch. The watch has a device that pretty much looks at your wrist and sees how much, like, it fires light at your wrist and sees how much light bounces off of your wrist. And based on how much light bounces off of it, it tells your heart rate based on how much blood is flowing through your wrist at that point.
I think it's a really interesting story, but I have to say I am conflicted about many aspects of this whole story on all sides. So as Jamie said, there was some sponsorship of this study, both from – it wasn't Fitbit as far as I could tell. It was the other company that was
– Basic Peak?
Yes. So they were found to be superior – and they also are the ones that funds it. Hey, maybe that's mm-hmm. that. This is the way it worked out. They're also funded by the legal team that brought the lawsuit. So yes. The legal team that brought the lawsuit against Fitbit funded the study that found that Fitbit was inaccurate. The last time I heard a story about this was this Andrew Wakefield getting funding from the team that was suing the people that were doing inoculations. I mean, this is it's something that immediately raises some suspicion to me.
Right. And that is something that Fitbit is arguing. In their countersuit, is that this was paid for by the people who are suing them. And then there's also a consumer report where they tested the Fitbit independently, and they said that it works great. But they also had
two people.
Yeah.
So it was basically, they were saying, well, maybe the reason that our two people worked great is because we really made sure the adjustments were right and all the other stuff. Cameron, I think you were jumping in to say who was Andrew Wakefield. I didn't really explain it. I'm sorry.
Andrew Wakefield was the researcher that originated the idea that autism's cause vaccine. Or I don't know if he originated the idea, but he produced the study that people cite to say that vaccines cause autism, which that study was eventually what's the right word for it? Recounted by the journal.
Retracted,
exactly. And I think he lost his medical license or whatever. Like it was fraudulent. Like it was actually fraudulent.
And the consequences there were huge. I mean, we're talking about Absolutely. Many, many children dying as a result of it. Here we're talking about a story which is small enough we can talk about it in non-hyperbolic terms. And I mean, I think that's important to remember because the lawsuit isn't alleging any actual damages by the people that are suing. It's a class action that's basically saying, well, we shouldn't have paid so much money for this device, not that there were any consequences. And I think the reason is that they know that the way that it's marketed is on a non-medical device. They might have exaggerated exactly how accurate it was, although it seems like the accuracy is somewhat contingent on user error. So I don't know. Like, I'm not sure how much of a consequence it really is that for certain activities over a certain heart rate, that there's a discrepancy really is a problem, especially since the initial study is suspect. So to get to behind that, I was when I was looking over some notes for the podcast, I was hanging out with a friend of mine that was wearing a Fitbit. I didn't realize at the time. And so I was asking her exactly why she likes her Fitbit. And she was basically saying her main reason is that she gets to see text messages from her phone. but she also says, you know, it lets you know that you're moving. It links activity for MyFitnessPal. So when she does a workout, it's sort of uploaded automatically. When it comes to heart rate, I was telling her about the inaccuracies. And she said, yeah, she noticed it's not accurate with sudden changes or heavy sweating. But she found it to be relatively accurate. Again, this is a sample size of one. This is just anecdotal. But she liked that she could see her heart rate in terms of stress. She had a stressful life event, and then actually noticed that her average heart rate was significantly elevated for 4 days subsequently. And you can also generally trust resting heart rate, which even this study seems to agree with, as a general measurement of fitness as you track a program over time. So it seems like it would definitely not be something we'd use for medical use. For someone that has a heart condition, if they're concerned, they should go to a doctor. But I don't know how bad the harm is for it being possibly inaccurate over a certain number of heart rates per minute.
Well, I think I should probably jump in here because my research is like I use actigraphy, which is the research version of a Fitbit, and this is one of my specialties, is looking at how accurate this data is, where there is nuance, where there is downfall. So one of the interesting things with Fitbit and related technology is the idea of the social aspect and the social benefit. So is someone more motivated to take more steps when they can see how much their friend took versus them? You know, if you make it a competition. And that's a completely different, it's a horse of a different color. The technology is not fantastic right now. However, it is getting better at such a greater rate. So people don't know this. This kind of technology has been around since the late 70s, and it has been used in sleep research since the mid 80s. The fact that it is commercialized now has vastly improved the timeline of this technology. Like, now we are seeing things jump ahead way quicker. They're getting way more easy to read, way more reliable than in, you know, the 30 years that you had them around and no one was interested in buying them except to measure sleep. So it is a good thing that people are interested in these trackers. I also want to note that Fitbit is also has a class action lawsuit for its sleep tracking because, frankly, it is not good at its sleep tracking. And at this point, there is no Fitbit-type technology that can reliably measure sleep in bad sleepers. If you have insomnia, if you're a shift worker, the technology is not quite there yet. So these are all aspects, and your friend might be very happy with hers, and it is reliable, especially resting. One thing that we haven't even brought up that I think is very interesting about PPG is the aspect of skin color. It may work better for different tones of skin than it does for others because, you know, this is a reflective technology, literally. It's bouncing light off of your wrist.
Right, and there have been similar technologies which I've heard have had trouble with people with different skin tones because they're, as you said, it's literally, you know, photo response. So it's obviously going to be altered by some by the person's skin color. So the thing is, it's not something that's intended by the engineers. It's something that's a consequence that maybe they didn't test for, or maybe just more difficult to engineer around.
Right. Well, I think at this point, it's not an engineering problem. We have, like, I have looked at a number of these types of monitoring devices, and the engineering and the software development, those have their own class, their own problems. What is really the issue is how do we distill this information to the public in a way that is useful for them and that they care about? Because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we measure, like in sleep research, we have watches that measure how much light exposure you have. And that's useful for us because we're looking at circadian rhythms, which is influenced by how much light the person is exposed to. So are you not being able to sleep because you have too much light when you go to bed? Is that waking you up? However, if I have a watch that's supposed to tell me how much activity I did or how well I slept last night, I don't care about how much light there is because I know. I have eyeballs.
And I mean, I think what really strikes me about this and the previous study we were talking about, or the previous issue we were talking about, is just how easy it would be to avoid a lot of these problems. For example, in this case, I think if Fitbit had basically said, had been even more cautious and included even more caveats, is like, you know, there may be some reason to believe that at certain ranges this device is less effective, or maybe make no guarantees about the accuracy, whatever. I mean, people would still buy it for the same reason because no one's buying it with an expectation that it would be accurate to within 1% of the what your actual heart rate would be.
And they do, they are very good. They're very good at picking the language to say that this is tracking, this is a range, this is not as accurate as you would get with a medical device. This is not a medical device, and no one is arguing that. But the people who are suing are arguing that they paid extra for something that's not that good.
Right. And again, that's sort of an amorphous concept. I mean, it's definitely excellent within certain ranges. It doesn't meet a particularly somewhat arbitrary criterion for what is good. Above a range of about 150 beats per minute. I mean, I'm not sure exactly which claim that Fitbit made is invalidated by the study. This is kind of suspicious, but I'm not sure how much of an issue it is. I mean, that it's not accurate at these ranges, if Fitbit never lied about it.
Well, and I do feel like I should point out that even in the study, it had moderate correlation. So it wasn't as close as the basis peak, but it was close. So it was never inaccurate.
I think it's good that the lawsuit is not claiming that they made a medical statement which is invalidated, because I wouldn't say that that's the case. I think that the lawsuit is basically alleging that the Fitbit is inaccurate in order to make some money off of these people. I think that the evidence that they're using is sort of ambiguous. Yeah, it didn't perform perfectly. We have no guarantee that the device was fitted and used correctly, but there's at least preliminary evidence to suggest that maybe in certain ranges of activity, the Fitbit doesn't work well. But I'm pretty suspicious of the study, and I wouldn't, if I was, let's say, a juror on that case, I wouldn't buy it unless I had some sort of external validation. And I'd really want to hear some really good justification for why the criteria for a strong enough relationship between the activity reported by the Fitbit and the activity reported by the device, the control device, has to be so perfect. It seems like they were really setting it up for failure. So I am not convinced that the Fitbit is totally inaccurate, even in certain ranges. And if it is, I don't know how bad the consequences are, as long as people are not expecting it to be medical. And I think that people aren't. I guess a fair resolution for this would be, you know, maybe the case is dismissed, but there is an injunction in which Fitbit has to emphasize even more that under certain conditions, the heart rate might not be accurate. It'll still correlate with what it should be. There'll still be a significant relationship between your true heart rate and the heart rate reported by the Fitbit, but maybe it's you know, unreliable in certain conditions, whatever. In that case, everything is accurate, like at least contingent with the limited amount of studies we have. I think that's a relatively easy fix, and I think it's in line with the problem in the initial issue we were talking about, wherein I think people that are writing these scientific articles could just have worded things more carefully or only reported on studies that had been published, and then we wouldn't have to discuss this at all. I mean, it's almost as exciting to talk about research that actually exists and quotes that actually exist than it is to just make up stuff. And I think it's frustratingly easy to avoid these kinds of issues. Just like I think it's frustratingly easy to sort of get into problems with this kinds of lawsuit about criteria that are really difficult to nail down. What is good enough as a Fitbit? What is good enough for a non-medical device?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, again, they've made claims that it's non-medical. So this is for, you're not using this if you're worried about getting a heart attack and you're monitoring your heart rate. My assumption is that this is marketed primarily towards getting people out to exercise, which being able to see how much you're exercising and how much you're moving around, even without the social aspect, I think could be pretty powerful. I know for like hydro usage, if there's a hydro monitor within the apartment that you can see, the amount of energy that people use is less than if they don't see it. Even if you just see that number and you're like, oh, I want to do more of that, or I want to use less of that in the case of hydro, that can be a really powerful benchmark to see where you are.
Hydro monitor, are you talking about water usage in the home?
Yeah, or electricity. So like in BC where I am, we have BC Hydro for energy. And I think it was in Germany the study was done. And I know that I think BC Hydro is looking into it too, where you have monitors in your apartment that you can see how much energy you're using. So there's a greater incentive to then, oh, I can shut these lights off and then the energy will be less. And then I'll save a bit of money. And you can even add an extra layer on that where there's periods of time where energy is more expensive, generally during the day when people are home with their lights on, and there's periods of energy where it's less expensive. So if the monitor in your house or your apartment showed you, oh, you're in the time frame where energy is really expensive right now because everyone's home, everyone's using their lights and their internet and their stove, there might be a greater incentive for people to use less.
We actually do have some relevant useful science summaries to bring up this time. We did have one earlier that said that in a sample of people using an online weight management system, more engagement with the social aspects of the program, so that's commenting on forums or messaging other users, was associated with greater weight loss. So that was a publication in a really good journal a few years ago. So it does seem that engaging from the social aspect, which Jamie mentioned briefly, can be kind of effective. Conversely, we also have a summary that says that smartphone apps alone, which were designed to help with weight loss, didn't seem to have any appreciable effect on weight loss over a 2-year span. So it seems like the social aspect may be something to emphasize among people that are curious about these devices. But yeah, I mean, even amongst all the criticism I'm giving on both sides here, I personally can't see myself using a Fitbit, but you know, I haven't, even though I think the hype's a bit ridiculous, I don't know. I haven't seen much to really criticize them for yet, I guess.
So I think this lawsuit, if I was as nerdy about the law as I am about actigraphy, I think I would just sit there all day with popcorn. I think this is a great even-sided debate, and it's really going to boil down to the arguments from either side and the law, which, you know, in terms of the research, we can argue that, yes, this might not be as accurate as other devices. But you can also argue that the company never said that it was going to be an EEG, and they never said that it was going to be better than another device. They said it's tracking your heart rate. It's not an exact measurement. So I think that's all legality. One thing that I am frustrated about, but also excited about with regards to this kind of wearable technology, is the rate at which it is advancing. So what is frustrating about proprietary technology like Fitbit or Jawbone or Basis Peak is the company owns the algorithms. They own the technology. We don't know how they determine a step or how they are determining exactly, you know, what this heart rate is or how long someone is sleeping. They all have their own calculations that aren't free for the public or for scientists to look at. They have the freedom to change their devices whenever they want to. So a Fitbit 1.0 versus a Fitbit 2.0 might not calculate a step the same way. So in terms of using that technology to determine validity, it is a constant battle because the technology is changing and it is not open source.
So I'm just wondering, just out of curiosity, as a sleep researcher, I mean, obviously, we're all pretty interested in the stuff we study, but most of us don't have devices that are related to it. So do you use a sleep monitoring device? And secondarily, if you, regardless of whether you do or not, do you think the ones that are on the market now are at all reliable in a way that's interpretable by the public? Like, are they useless or are they useful in limited use? And I guess, do you use one yourself to sort of nerd out over your own data?
I do not use one consistently. I have tested some before, either ones that we have only for measuring sleep in our lab, which are not consumer products, they're lab equipment. I've also tested some for different companies and given them feedback on their design. And I've looked into mining the data from different companies like Fitbit and looking at their algorithms and the way that they draw this technology. I've not only used wearables for the wrist, but I've tested wearables that you put on your bed, apps for your phone. It's all the same base technology, which is measuring whether or not there's movement. Beyond that, there are validated devices, and they're getting better with each iteration. So it's the same as, you know, oh, should you buy a CD player or should you, you know, buy a DVD player or whatever? You know, don't get the first generation, but once all your friends have one, then it works well enough that you can use it too. I think at the end of the day, what's important about your sleep from an objective perspective is going to be different than what the consumer wants. The consumer wants something that is going to improve how well they feel about their health or how, you know, their subjective health. So if you have an app that tells you, well, you didn't sleep well last night, and you say, yeah, I know that. Now what do I do? And it doesn't tell you, then you don't want that. If you've got an app that says you slept great last night and you don't think you did, you also don't want that.
Right. So people should basically rely on the one metric they can trust, which is their subjective sleep experience.
Well, yeah. And what I always tell people with sleep and everything else is if it works for you, it works. If you like your Fitbit, wear your Fitbit. If you don't like your Fitbit, you can take it off.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, I do wonder sometimes, I sometimes worry about the scientific data that the public requests about themselves and receives. I mean, the big issue, and I mean, this is a great one for a different episode, is, you know, services like 23andMe, where they identify particular genetic polymorphisms or mutations that people might have without a lot of context. And I worry a lot about how people interpret that information, because the actual usefulness might be pretty minimal, and people can really change their behaviors in life based on information that's either based on preliminary studies or a lot more nuanced than they think. I think with sleep, it's a little bit more clear cut. But again, I mean, if someone says they get a device that says they spent, you know, 47 minutes in stage 3 sleep, I don't know exactly how they're supposed to interpret that in terms of meaningful changes in their life. So I agree with you that it's good for people to be interested in their own sleep habits to make sure they get enough of it. But I think where it's difficult to interpret what we have currently in terms of data.
Well, and sleep hygiene is a great medical help. So if you enroll in a sleep hygiene program that's telling you how to improve your own sleep, and that works well for people who are not sleeping well because of maybe they're not taking their sleep as something important. However, something like sleep hygiene isn't going to help you if you have a sleep disorder, if you have sleep apnea or insomnia. Tracking your sleep or trying to improve your sleep based on these suggestions you might get from your smartphone aren't going to work as well for you as it is for someone whose main problem is just that they aren't dedicating the time or energy to getting good sleep.
Right. It's like the worry about the problem can make it worse when you're already engaged with that issue.
Jamie, can you explain what sleep hygiene is? Because I think that people might not know, and it's a confusing term.
Yes, absolutely. So sleep hygiene is the same as oral hygiene or, you know, taking a shower. So it's the idea that you want to clean up your sleep schedule. So that might be, and different programs say different things. Same as, you know, your dentist probably says floss every day, brush twice a day, whatever. In sleep hygiene, it usually says like, hey, turn off all your electronics 2 hours before you go to bed or whatever. Like, go to bed at 10 o'clock instead of ? Get out of bed at 6 o'clock instead of ? And just make the dedication to be on a schedule with your sleep, same as you would be on a schedule for your skin maintenance, your dental maintenance, or, you know, if you were going to the gym and seeing a personal trainer.
I think the take home for all of the issues we discussed today is don't believe the hype. When it comes to potentially suspicious media articles that are representing scientific articles, check them out yourself. And when it comes to claims by companies about biofeedback devices or biometric devices, you know, take their measurements with a grain of salt.
I do want to put one caveat. If someone tells you that the Useful Science Podcast is amazing, you should believe them. You should believe that hype. Yeah. You should tell your friends. Like, if you're listening to this podcast right now, tell your friends. This is the one thing that actually lives up to all of the hype, man.
100%.
This is the podcast you should be listening to.
My name is Cameron Spencer. You can follow me on Twitter at USONIC, E-U-S-O-N-I-C.
I'm Ian Mahar. You can follow me on Twitter at I-A-N-M-A-H-A-R.
I'm JBK Devine. You can follow me on Twitter at JK_Devine.
I'm Lindsay Oxton, and I don't have Twitter.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a very useful week. Here's how I see it. It's been a year since we put an episode out. So, you know, we spent a year working on this episode, so it should be really good.
Amazing.
Yes, that's right. Super polished.
Right, yeah. You know, it takes a long time to produce good content like we do.
Sure.